Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals and to Fort Worth. We have Houston attorneys and Cleburne attorneys, is that correct? Okay, welcome, thank you. My name is Ann Gardner, and to my left is Justice Lee Gabriel. To my right is Justice Bob McCoy, and we're your panel for today. And you are the only case set on our docket this afternoon. So we'll go ahead and get started if you're ready. I'll ask Bonnie to call the case and introduce the attorneys quickly.
The court will now call Bain Family First Limited Partnership and Bain Family Management Corporation versus EOG Resources Incorporated. May it please the court, Mr. Scott Kane will represent the argument for the appellant. Mr. Lawrence Levinowski will argue for the appellant.
Thank you, Bonnie. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay, come forward.
May it please the court, my name is Scott Kane. I'll be arguing on behalf of the appellants in this case. This is a case of an appeal from a grant of summary judgment. The case law is pretty well settled. There's not a lot of argument about the case law, but there is a lot of argument about the facts. In fact, this case arrives from an oil and gas relationship in June 22, 2004. An oil and gas lease as well as a joint operating agreement entered into between EOG and Fain. There were several wells drilled, and EOG had sued Fain for suit on a sworn account and breach of contract. There also, part of the record is some email communications between the parties and an unobjected to affidavit of Dr. Ricky Fain. That we believe created a fact issue that created an error for the trial court to grant the summary judgment in the case below. I'm going to talk about the procedural posture of the case, what was moved upon and what wasn't moved upon, and then I'm going to talk about some specific factual issues that there's genuine issues of material fact.
Okay, can I interrupt you for a second? We entered an order allowing you to substitute in as counsel, but the order denied the filing of the amended brief that raised the new issues regarding the fact issues. I believe that on the latter point, we made a mistake and should have allowed the amendment. And I noticed that your reply brief is essentially the same as the original, as the amended brief you would have filed that raises the new issues. Originally, we had thought that it would be unfair to require the appellees to rebrief their reply after allowing you to file an amended brief, but I believe that we now agree that the rules of appellate procedure want the courts to get to the merits and not to use forfeiture or briefing waiver and so forth to avoid that whenever possible, and that in the interest of justice, your reply brief is accepted, and we will allow the appellees adequate time to reply to those issues as if to a new brief, because there are different issues being raised than were raised the first time. And so with that clarification and change of our ruling, I apologize, but we will go forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Justice. And I think it's two sides of the same coin. The issue for the court to determine, and we all know that well-settled Texas law is that a trial court is not permitted to grant relief that is not specifically requested. That exceeds the bounds of our summary judgment practice in Texas. So it's really two sides of the same coin. What was moved upon and what wasn't moved upon? And regarding what was actually moved upon, there were genuine issues of material fact in it. Quite frankly, when you look at the summary judgment record in this case, the record raises more questions than it settles in this case. Regarding the first point of the relief that was not requested, when you look at the timeline, August the 29th of 2011, the first summary judgment motion was moved upon. September the 28th, the motion was granted. February the 1st, the second motion was moved upon, and then the amended answer and counterclaims was raised on February the 15th. EOG had moved upon several parts in their second motion, but what they did not move upon and what was not part of the summary judgment procedure was the issues, counterclaim, or defense of modification, waiver, rescission, breach of an informal fiduciary relationship. In fact, EOG admits in their pleadings and in their briefing that they didn't move upon the issue of fiduciary duty. Now, granted, Texas law is very well settled that you cannot have a formal fiduciary relationship in a lessor-lessee relationship, but it does not knock out the possibility of an informal relationship, and a relationship like this is out of the ordinary. In fact, some of the record demonstrates that EOG recognized that this was not something that EOG had entered into with the joint operating agreement. So it is possible that you had a venture between the parties that was very different. But irrespective, it was not moved upon, and it was improper for the trial court to grant on that point. Also, some of the other issues were breach of the duty to act as a reasonably prudent operator and breach of the duty to reasonably develop the oil and gas lease. Those issues were never raised in the summary judgment proceeding, and it was error for the trial court to grant that. Now, admittedly, when you look at the live pleadings of the parties, the defendant and the trial level's pleadings are very difficult to read and to ascertain precisely what claims and defenses were raised. But the proper procedure for EOG or the other party is to file special exceptions to give you the opportunity to clear up those. But I do admit that it is difficult in reading the trial pleadings. But those issues were never moved upon. Texas law is very well settled. When you file an amended pleading, if the trial court looks at the pleadings and makes the determination in the order that they considered all the pleadings, if an amendment is filed, it is presumed that leave of court was granted unless a motion to strike the amendment was filed. And so modification in particular was raised for the first time in that issue. So for that reason, those issues need to be remanded for further proceedings because it was improper for the trial court to grant relief that wasn't requested. I want to spend the rest of my time talking about the genuine issues of material fact. There were several that were raised in the summary judgment record. First of all, regarding the issue of modification.
Well, let's stop just for a second. If there is any issue which was not resolved by the trial court, then this is an interlocutory appeal and we can't even be here. If you were correct that there is an issue remaining in the trial court, then this can't be up here at all because it's not a full and final judgment from which to appeal.
I think that would be correct, Justice McCoy, but the concern that I have is I don't want the record to look as though a partial grant of summary judgment was granted on these other issues. I think there's fact issues, and so when it gets sent back down to the trial court needs to be aware of the fact that there are fact issues. But I think you're right. It does present a potentially jurisdictional issue that, quite frankly, I haven't thought of as I stand here today.
Which we would be required to look at whether it's raised or not.
Absolutely.
For the preliminary matter. Well, wasn't there a second final, a second summary judgment order granted that states that it is a final judgment and denies all other relief?
There is. It has the standard Mother Hubbard language, and that's why that language is erroneous, because the trial court granted more relief than what was moved upon. So when you look in the analysis at what was moved upon on summary judgment, those issues, modification, rescission, breach of fiduciary duty, breach of the various duties was never moved upon, yet the trial court had granted that. I handled a similar case that I cite as an unpublished opinion, the Weber case in my brief. I handled that with the Court of Appeals in Waco, and we had a similar situation to this case. I was on the other side of the issue. We were granted a summary judgment motion. Literally on the day of the hearing, the other party filed an amendment, and the Waco Court of Appeals sent us back on that particular issue, but they affirmed on the granting of summary judgment. So in answer to Justice McCoy's concern, I don't want to see us go back and then you affirm on the summary judgment, what was actually moved upon, when there were genuine issues of material fact, because there were, and those were improper. Had the summary judgment order encompassed and the motion encompassed all of the issues, it still would have been erroneous because there were genuine issues of material fact regarding the various issues.
All I was saying was, it seemed to me the first place that we went was to determine if there was a full and final adjudication of all parties and all issues below, because if there's not, we don't have jurisdiction to hear anything.
Well, when the judgment...
I'm not saying you're right or wrong. I'm just saying if that were the case.
When the judgment itself says this judgment is final, disposes of all claims and all parties and is appealable, I mean...
I believe we're properly
here. I think your argument
here.
That it's disposing of claims that weren't moved upon, it seems like to me that...
What he's saying is that I think what you're saying here, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but try these. If they didn't move for summary judgment on causes of action C and D, it doesn't make any, of A, B, C, and D, it doesn't make any difference what the order says. They didn't move for it. So the trial court couldn't grant it. And if it couldn't grant it, then the whole thing can't be reviewed by us because we don't have jurisdiction over an interlocutory appeal of this nature.
With all due respect, Justice McCoy, I think the issue is a little bit different.
Right.
I think the case law that I have reviewed says that when, and you typically run into this situation when you have a very broad encompassing motion for summary judgment, or you have a typical order that says motion is granted, something of that nature, which is what we have. Then, as a reviewing court, you have to look at what was moved upon and was it correct or was it incorrect. In this particular case, just like the Weber case that I cited, and there are a few other cases that deal with that, a trial court that grants more relief than requested, it's an error to do that. I don't know that it's necessarily a jurisdictional issue if you have your Mother Hubbard language. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to get before you to review. And so I think your analysis is, if these claims were not moved upon, then it was error for the trial court to grant those. But then you have to do the analysis of what was actually moved upon, and that's your more traditional summary judgment review. And in that instance, there were genuine issues of material fact on even what was moved upon. For example, you look at the breach of contract or the suit on a sworn account, and those two instances, there were fact issues, and modification is very, very important. You will see some quotes in some of the emails and the affidavit of Dr. Ricky Fain that EOG had communicated to Fain that it would drill one well at a time and carry them on the cost of each well until they went into production. EOG took a very inconsistent position in this case. It's ironic that one of their arguments is quasi-estoppel. But the one who's taken the inconsistent position in this case has been EOG. The summary judgment record shows that they told Fain that you have wells that were producing to get Fain to enter into subsequent wells and to continue the joint operating agreement. But at the same time, they've now taken a different position that the wells were not productive.
Let's stop just a minute. Did you ever receive royalty payments from the wells that purportedly led you to invest in the subsequent wells?
No. Royalty payments were not distributed. EOG...
All right. If you didn't receive royalty payments, then what is the explanation for why you would believe they're producing and yet I'm receiving no royalty payments?
When EOG tells you that, we have email in the summary judgment record as well as the uncontested affidavit of Dr. Ricky Fain that says that EOG told them it was capable of producing and paying quantities, but they didn't have a pipeline. And this is very important, too.
All right. Now, tell just a minute. What, okay, it's your specific evidence that you have that you were fraudulently induced into participating in the second well is their representation that we have a well capable of producing. In other words, we've got a good first well. Let's drill another one.
That plus they paid shut-in royalties. They didn't pay actual royalties, but they did pay shut-in
royalties. The bottom line is you have an email or an affidavit or a letter or something in there saying, in essence, we have a good well capable of producing.
That's correct.
That's the sum total of the fraudulent inducement from your standpoint.
Or the modification.
I don't know if I would go quite that far, but we say it raises us more than a scintilla of evidence to support those.
Okay, well, what else? Is there any other evidence that you have about fraudulent inducement other we got a good well, let's drill another one?
Well, the fact that they had told EOG had told Fain that they would carry him on the wells on the cost and go one well at a time. That is the heart of the case of our fraudulent inducement case. That is correct. It is the heart of it.
What? Okay. Then, of course, carry you could mean a couple of different things. It could be we're going to pay for your part, or it could mean we're going to front the vertical expenses. And then you'll owe us those vertical expenses once we go horizontal or restart.
That's correct,
production.
Justice McCoy.
And what does that have to do with fronting you or covering you? What does that have to do with inducing you or fraudulently inducing you into going with the second well?
Well, when they make a statement that it's productive, that the first well, the 1H is productive,
I got that.
That we're going to go forward with the second well, And do you want to participate? And then they send the letter asking you to participate in the second well. Fain takes the risk of doing that. I see that I'm out of time. Could I have more minutes on?
I think, counsel, Judge, I think we spent a lot of time talking about.
Well, that's fine.
I think we ought to have some extra time for both parties.
Okay, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Thank you. And so you look at that timeline of going forward, and that is a huge, huge point in this case. But I think you raised a good point. At the summary judgment stage, the questions that you asked are the quintessential fact issues. What does that mean? That is something that the trier of fact that will judge the credibility of the relative positions of the party needs to make a determination. It's not something that should be disposed of at the summary judgment stage. Those are fact issues where you have credibility of witness. And in this case, the credibility of the actual documents, the billing records, is very much at issue and should have been weighed upon by.
What does that have to do with fraudulently inducing facts that fraudulently induced you into going with the second well? I'm hearing you. We got a good first well. What else?
At this point, that is primarily it.
Okay, let me ask you about releasing the property and your lost opportunity. What facts do you have that you lost an opportunity to release? And I'm not talking about, well, a neighbor couldn't release because he was with EOG. What about your property?
Well, when you look at our property, you have the affidavit of Dr. Fain, and I believe there was one other affidavit that was offered regarding the value of leasing the minerals at that time. And basically you're looking at a million and a half in shut-in or bonus, upfront paid bonus money. That had EOG been forthright about it, and this is important too. And the primary term of this lease was to expire on June 22nd, 2011. That is a crucial date. EOG paid the shut-in royalties, telling Dr. Fain that the well was capable of producing and paying quantities. The joint operating agreement and the lease both terminated on June 22nd, 2007. When you look at the bills that comprise all of their case that they're seeking payment for, those bills came after that date, after the agreements had terminated by their own terms.
Okay, I'm hearing that, but what does that have to do with releasing? Do you have something from somebody that says, we want to lease your property, and here's what we're willing to pay for it, or something along that line?
We didn't have that opportunity to go get that because at the time, EOG said that you've got a well capable of producing and paying quantities. The lease is carried forward beyond the primary term, so the opportunity to go release never came up, and we didn't know that until this litigation when they took a different position that the well was not capable of paying and producing.
Then how would you get around the argument that you're speculating that you would be able to release it?
Well, if we are afforded the opportunity to present this at trial, there's no doubt in the Barnett Shale and Somerville County, Johnson County, and Tarrant County, when you're looking at 2007 and 2008, that we're going to be able to demonstrate what bonus money was paid, quarter royalties were paid consistently through that. So it's not going to be speculative, but again, we didn't get to that point because summary judgment cut us off before. So again, there is a genuine issue of material fact on that they had to be able to show that there was no issue of material fact. They didn't do that. There's a fact issue.
So if they were saying there was some production, then it didn't. Then the lease didn't terminate on June 22nd, 2007.
The lease itself, the joint operating agreement says that it continues on as long as there is a lease in place. The only lease that was involved in this joint operating agreement was the Fane oil and gas lease. When you look at the Fane oil and gas lease, it has the typical producer's 88 style of language that says that at the end of the primary term, June 22nd, 2007, that EOG could pay shut-in royalties if they had a well that was capable of producing and paying quantities, but because of market or some other condition, they weren't able to hook it up, if you will. There's evidence in the summary judgment record that demonstrates that EOG told Fane, we can't hook it up. We don't have a pipeline to hook it up right now, but it's capable of paying and producing quantities. It's a productive well. So that would continue on the process. And the invoices that EOG is seeking repayment on, 400 and something thousand, laying aside the argument that when you look at it, there are genuine issues about whether or not those are valid and good invoices, but you look at the dates, they all took place after June 22nd, 2007, and now that they've taken the position, the inconsistent position that the wells were not capable of paying and producing quantities, the lease terminated on June 22nd, 2007.
Did they have an option to re-lease?
They could have negotiated just like anyone else, gone back to the Fane entities and said, I'd like to lease it, but they had to start all over at that point.
Okay.
Let me ask you one quick question about the suit on sworn account. You maintain that the fact that the second answer was not verified was a Scrivener's error. But I don't see any cases that support the position that we're just supposed to accept that and say, well, okay, then it's okay. You didn't mean to do it, so that's okay. Do you have any such authority?
There is no authority on either side for this factual scenario. What the authority says is that once you file a proper verified denial, it destroys the prima facie case of a suit on a sworn account. In fact, most of the case law goes through the history of Rule 185 and what got us to this point. And one of the cases I cite says that it's not supposed to be used as a gotcha type rule. But when you look at his amended pleading, and this is important, when you look at the time that the summary judgment motion was filed, his first amended pleading was live and it was executed. But when you look at that compared with the second amended, the language is exactly identical to the first one, and the only thing is, for some reason, quite frankly, the lawyer left off the signature block on that one, but he makes the same arguments in the second amended that he did in the first and the primary, attacking the suit on a sworn account and put those issues into controversy at that point. So you've got two options. You can determine that there's been an abandonment of the claim, which is a waiver, a voluntary relinquishment, or that it was a Scrivener's error. There's no case law that I could find on either side of that issue. This is a unique issue of law that I think is being presented for the first time on this particular type of a factual scenario.
But I believe that affirmative defenses survive even if you don't verify your sworn denial.
They typically do, and
how would that play into this?
We say it certainly could not be part of the summary judgment motion because he had a verified denial on file at the time the motion was filed. So they could not have moved on it at that point in time. Absolutely, they couldn't have. They now make a unique argument. It's kind of a backup argument. Well, if we lose on that, well, he somehow, and they're using it as a gotcha rule. Oops, there was a mistake made. You lose. That's the nuts and bolts of the argument that EOG has to make on this. But the rule was never designed and intended to be a gotcha rule on that.
The rule was designed and intended that if you don't verify your denial, that there's a consequence for that.
But in this scenario, there was a verified denial. It destroyed the presumption. So for the court to affirm the summary judgment on that point, you would have to revive what had already been destroyed when he filed his first amended and his original petition. you would have to have, and quite honestly, it would make new law in Texas and create a new body of law that doesn't exist.
Well, either way, it's going to create new law, is it not?
Potentially.
So the both motions for summary judgment were filed while there was a verified denial on file.
That is correct.
So the second amended without the verification was filed after both summary judgment motions were filed and there was no response or
no
objection
motion to strike,
to
no objection.
Allow a curing of that problem.
Okay. That's okay. Correct. And there is a body of case law that if you have a technical defect, you have an opportunity to cure that defect, and that falls in line with other areas of the law that would be consistent with that. So when you look at the policy of what a suit on a sworn account is designed to do, it's not designed to be trapped for the wary, but it is designed where there is no dispute to put those issues in controversy. But in this particular case, you look at the pleading, and it verbatim matches the first amended pleading on the verified part of the pleading. I have no explanation for you as to why the lawyer did not have a verification signature on the last page like he did on the first two. It's simply the only explanation that makes any logical sense in this case is that it had to have been a Scribner's error. There just isn't. Otherwise, he would have, if he intended to abandon that pleading in that defensive position, he would have removed that language from the substance of the pleading.
Well, thank you, counsel. Your time is up now.
Thank you.
We will hear from EOG. And
may it please the court. My name is Larry Levinowski, and along with Jeff Spencer, my co-counsel, we represent EOG Resources. EOG is an exploration and production company. We are here today because EOG was involved in a standard boilerplate, standard in the industry, joint operating agreement with the typical addenda that govern when you have to pay your bills with the appellant, Fain. Fain was in two wells with us. All of what I'm telling you is established by the facts in the case. There's no dispute as to the existence of the agreement, the execution of the agreement, all the terms of the agreement, and what the agreement said that he agreed to and what he was going to do. All of that was established, and there's been no debate about that. Fain agreed to participate in two wells with us. We agreed to drill those wells, pay all the money up front, and then bill him monthly. And according to the specific terms of the addenda of the agreement, he was to pay those bills, whether the bills were accurate or not, within 30 days. That's the way the industry works. That's the standard. And you then have an opportunity for 2 years that if you have any debate on whether or not we're overcharging you, you can audit us and you're not waiving anything. That's specific to the agreement, and I can cite you to the clerk's record because that's part of the evidence. Fain elected to get into these two wells, and there were two wells that we agreed, and it's important for me to tell you this, there were two vertical wells that we agreed to drill and that we would not charge him for. Those were monitor wells. The wells that we were in with him to explore for oil were horizontal wells in the Barnett Shale. EOG agreed to drill the two vertical wells at our sole cost, and he would not be billed for those. The reason I'm telling you that is because as the trial court, the trial judge came to find out and understand, part of what their argument is relates to bills that are related to those vertical wells that they were never charged for. So that's why I'm telling you that. They were only charged ever for the two horizontal wells. From the very inception, Fain never paid any of his bills. Much of what I've heard in all of the pleadings, I've heard in the two summary judgment responses, and all of the many motions that have been filed in this trial court and now on appeal are complete fairy tales. He never paid any of his bills from the inception, so any fraudulent inducement claims, he would have to explain why he was not paying on the first well. But that's an aside. That's an emotional argument. I bring that up, however, because the credibility of Fain in this case is so vitally important to you justices, because they have said pretty much anything they can say to convince you that we have done something wrong. The trial judge was made to understand by our laborious collection of information, evidence, and our picking through all of the evidence, including the emails, et cetera, to show him that, in fact, what they were saying was just flat not true and not accurate. And let me give you one quick example, if I might. In their pleadings, counsel states, and counsel is to be forgiven because he has now substituted in for the trial counsel, but he states the following. He says, EOG told Fain, Mr. Dollins, an EOG representative, told Fain, until we have seen that they would carry Fain, unquote, until we have seen some production. And I wrote it down when counsel said a few minutes ago what he said. He said, and I'll quote you, he said, this issue, he said that his, these words, that this is the heart of the case, is what he said. Now, remember what he said. He said that we said we would carry them, we would carry Fain on the wells until there was production. I have the email. It's Clerk's Record 505. It says, this is an email from Mr. Dollins. He says, Ricky, and I'll skip down to the important part, we will carry you on the vertical well, as we discussed in our previous email. Remember the vertical well I told you about? We drilled two of them. We paid for them. Subsequent wells will not be drilled until we have seen some production. There never was ever any agreement that we would ever carry them on any of the horizontal wells. That's made up. When we filed the case, the first thing they did was they challenged the venue. They lost on the venue. They challenged the judge. They tried to have the judge recused. They lost on the recusal. We filed a motion for summary judgment. We brought all the evidence to the court. And Justice Gabriel, you make an interesting point, because the answer was not sworn, and the answer was also so general that it was not a sufficient answer under the rules governing sworn accounts. And we brought that to their attention. So any argument that we did not bring it to their attention is not true. We brought it to their attention, and they never modified it. They quickly filed another answer after we filed our second motion for summary judgment, but they never corrected it. So whether or not it was verified and whether or not that was a Scrivener's error or not, it's an insufficient answer anyway. But what we did was we went ahead and we filed our motion for summary judgment. We laboriously got all the evidence together to show that they just flat hadn't paid, that we had billed them correctly, et cetera, et cetera. We laid it all out. And, of course, contrary to what counsel said, even if they do file a sworn answer, we still are permitted to go forward and file a motion for summary judgment, which we did, and we can disprove what they said. And that would have been very easy to do, because contained within the body of their answer are contrary things to what they swore to in their request for admission. That's how outrageous it is. So we explained to the judge all of this at the trial level. And at the hearing at the trial on the first summary judgment, the judge was prepared to grant us all of our relief, but they raised an issue on what counsel was talking about on this, these problems with the invoices, these bills that were charged that weren't appropriate. Well, there was a load of rocks that had been used that they claimed to the court just extemporaneously, all of a sudden. It wasn't in there. There was nothing. We had no record of what they were talking about. They exclaim during the course of our hearing that we're being charged for these rocks. And I'm trying to scramble and figure out what they're talking about. I come to find out when the judge, he became concerned, as you're concerned. He became concerned that there was a problem with whether or not we were cheating these people. So he did not give us the amount of money that related specifically. He cross-examined them hard at the hearing, but he did not give us our judgment on that $50,000. So I left the hearing, and I didn't get my full relief. So I went back, and I redoubled my efforts, and I filed a final judgment. a request for a final judgment. I went in and I proved to the court that the 50,000 was inaccurate, that these rocks had nothing whatsoever to do with any of the expenses that we were charging them. We had never charged them for the rocks. All of the expenses that we had charged were carefully laid out. We had affidavits that showed how we charged it. It was sent to them in the regular course of business. They were obligated that they had to pay it monthly, whether it was accurate or not, and challenge us. They said, and this is another one of what I like to think about as being made up, they say in their pleadings, they say they were stopped from auditing. We prevented them from auditing. And as usual, they misquote and take out of context what the email said. I would refer you to Clerk's Record 334. Dr. Fain, who's the head of this organization, wanted information on the rocks. And the woman at EOG said, we cannot make copies of this many invoices and don't have the manpower. They took that and wrote in their pleading, and you'll find it in their brief, and I have it here, but I don't want to take my time to find it. They took that to mean that we said they couldn't audit. But if you read the very next sentence of Clerk's Record 334, you'll see that it says, we request that you conduct an audit. We invited them to conduct an audit, and they never did. And the reason they never did was because there was absolutely no reason why they shouldn't pay their bill. Now, when I filed the second motion for summary judgment, I asked for relief. Yes, admittedly, they did after I filed the motion, right after that. They had all this time, but they filed another answer. And in the answer, they changed things around. But contrary to what counsel would have you believe, they didn't plead new causes of action. If you compare...
They plead modification.
Modification had been pled previously, Justice. Right. They did not plead any new causes of action.
Okay, let's return to where we started this oral argument with his assertion that the motion for summary judgment did not address all pled causes of action, and hence the granting of a full and final relief, Mother Hubbard clause, didn't in fact cover all of the causes of action because they weren't moved upon. What is your response?
Justice McCoy, I dispute that. We asked in our final summary judgment request, we asked for a full and final summary judgment on all causes of action that we had and all of their counterclaims. We specifically asked for that, and taking their case, their Chesser case, at the very end of Chesser, it says, and I'll quote from it, it says, must establish his entitlement to a summary judgment on the issues expressly presented to the court by conclusively proving all essential elements of his cause of action or defense as a matter of law. That's precisely what we did. We went in and we proved it on two different causes of action. We proved it on our breach of contract, and we proved it on our suit on sworn account. They made no effort at the trial level, no effort whatsoever, and that's the proof that the appeals court looks at. They made no effort whatsoever to try to dispute what we were claiming about these bills.
But they had counterclaims such as the breach of informal fiduciary duty and breach of duty to act as a reasonable operator. You're saying all that was pled before their last...
Oh, absolutely, Justice Gabriel. And I'll tell you, they had all that, but there's not a scintilla of evidence of any of that. And there's no breach of fiduciary duty with respect...
Wait. We're just talking about pleading now. Now, you acknowledge they pled it. Now, are you telling me that you addressed it in your motion for summary judgment and disproved one element as a matter of law or whatever you needed to do?
Well, we pled for complete and final relief on all their counterclaims and on our two claims, breach of contract and sworn account. And we asked the court to rule finally, and we presented to the court our evidence. I don't believe we have the obligation to go in, for example, on their affirmative defense. And earlier I said that they did not plead any new causes of action. They did plead two additional things that I want to make you aware of. They pled for the first time in this last amended pleading, which is the second amended pleading, they pled for rescission and they pled for waiver. And as the court knows, rescission is a remedy and waiver is a defense. They did not plead any new claims. And so by virtue of, so the notion that we were surprised, honestly, by the fact that they were charging us with all these things that they were doing, but we weren't surprised by their pleading because they had pleaded previously. And again, if you compare the two pleadings side by side, which I have done three or four times to make sure I could tell you this, there are only those two new things. Now, they changed the words around, and it is, counsel admits, it is very strange the way they pled, and they don't really say anything. But I'll tell you this. If you look at their prayer on their live pleading, it asks for lease cancellation, which, by the way, I have to address this to you. If you go to the clerk's record, and I believe it is, I don't want to take my time to find it, but I can find it for you because I found it earlier, and I'm sorry I don't have it right available. If you look at the clerk's record, you will see that the lease cancels automatically. It cancels automatically at the end of the primary term if there's no production. And by the way, this statement that they made where they said that we had stated that that there was production in paying quantities, I challenge counsel in his rebuttal period right now to refer you to the clerk's record or any record whatsoever where he can show you where we said there was ever production in paying quantities.
Well, I think he said, if I understood him right, that the first well was capable of producing in paying quantities.
He actually, I don't mean to.
Is that correct?
That is not the way I heard it, Justice McClain.
Is your position that the first well was capable of producing in paying quantities?
Without sounding flippant to you, I will tell you that any well you drill is capable of producing in paying quantities. You don't know until you frack it, until you start producing it, until you see what it does after a period of time. And that's not being flippant. That's just the way it is. The notion that we would have gone to Dr. Fain and told him, we've got a well and we're not going to do it, it's all a fairy tale. If you look at the total of the emails, you will see they pull one sentence, as I illustrated to you earlier.
Okay, wait, I think we're wandering here. Well, let me go to something else then. What is necessary to shut in a well? Does it have to be capable of producing in paying quantities? Does it have to have produced? Or can you just drill a well and say, I'm going to pay shut-in payments to extend the lease?
You must have production to pay a
production,
shut-in.
But I thought these wells never produced, so how could you pay shut-in?
Justice McCoy, that's the confusion. Wells may produce a small amount, but they may not produce in paying quantities, and so they're not commercially available. They're no good to pipe out and work. We had seven times. We paid seven times what they're responsible for. I assure you, we wanted them to be producers.
But I thought that if there was no pipeline attached to the wells, they couldn't produce.
Well,
hence, how could you pay shut-in?
Well, the payments that he's talking about is you are permitted under the terms of this specific lease if the well is capable of producing, not necessarily in commercial quantities, and not necessarily that you will hook it up and pay it, but if it's possible that it will produce, you could pay the shut-ins to give yourself more time to develop it. That's what was done. Ultimately, we found, Justice McCoy, that it was not going to be commercially reasonable, and so we had to shut it in, but right, close it off and plug and abandon it. And as I said earlier, and I need to emphasize to the trial judge, I assure you, we're paying seven times what they're paying. We want it to be a producer. We have no reason to mislead anybody.
You paid seven times in shut-in payments?
No, Justice Gardner. We our share of all of the cost of Jillian's wells is seven times what theirs is.
Seven-eighths.
Yeah, seven-eighths.
By your accounting, when did the lease end?
I don't have the exact date, but I will tell you I believe it was a three-year primary term, and what happened was we tried to get it produced. We could not get it to produce, and so it naturally terminated. This issue about us refusing to release their lease and their not being able to lease, I challenge counsel to talk to you about whether or not people top lease all the time. There is absolutely, positively no reason why they couldn't have gone out and leased this property. Absolutely none, and that's what we would have shown if it was a valid issue. The fact of the matter is, when the lease terminated, it terminated. There was no obligation. Ask counsel to show you the specific part of the lease that requires us to go and file a release of the lease. There's no requirement for us to do that. Nobody does it unless they're required to do it because it just terminates naturally.
Is there a provision in the lease that says if we pay shut-in royalties 90 days after the last payment, the lease expires?
Yes.
Something to that effect?
Yes, I think there is something like that.
We could calculate, it could be calculated when the lease actually ended because it ended a finite period of time after you paid your last shut-in payment, which is what was continuously extending the lease period.
Absolutely, and you've given me an opportunity. If I understood Justice Gardner correctly, I'm going to be given an opportunity to file a response brief to their amended brief.
Yes.
I will address that issue specifically in my response brief. I will tell you when we paid the shut-in or what we paid as far as the shut-in goes, and I'll straighten that issue out for you.
And when the lease ended, because you wouldn't be billing them for any operations that occurred after the end of the after the lease ended. Correct?
May I speak to that, Justice McCoy,
well, yes.
Please? Because that was something in the lease that they've got to know is just a red herring. Their implication that once the lease terminates, that they suddenly have no more obligation to pay their contractual obligations, not under the lease, but under the joint operating agreement, is crazy. What would happen? You would have a situation where people had joint operating agreements with other people and then the lease terminated for non-production, and then the operator would get stuck with all the money that they had fronted on the expenses? Of course not. The way it works is the lease terminates. The JOA is not going to be of any force and effect going forward, but it's still of force and effect for the expenses, et cetera, and your obligations to plug and abandon. Heck, we would have all over the state of Texas, we'd have unplugged and unabandoned wells if that were the rules, because all the non-operating working interest owners, as soon as the lease terminated, they would walk away and they would leave the operator holding the bag. So the notion that they've got some argument that once the lease terminates, they're suddenly off the hook and they don't have to pay us is nonsense. That doesn't make any sense. And the most, and my time is up. May I proceed for just another minute?
Close. Mm-hmm.
The point I was trying to make was this. In much of what was pled, you will have a tendency, unless you look carefully, you will have a tendency, unfortunately, to be misled. The modification argument where they suggest that we promised we would carry them on the wells. No, not carry them on the wells. We're going to carry them until we get production. No. We're going to carry them on that well forever. We're going to pay it, the vertical well. Never, ever said. Please look at 505, Clerk's Record 505. And if I could conclude by just saying this. We at the trial level, we went through and we produced for the judge all of the evidence to prove the cause of action under breach of contract, under sworn account. We did everything right. We put out all of the evidence that we needed to put out there for him. We gave them an opportunity. We objected to their answer that wasn't sworn, that was too general in nature. We did everything we could, and counsel's predecessor was a real gentleman and a very fine man, and I was happy to do it with him. I worked with him very well. But the fact of the matter is there was nothing they could do to defend that case, and that's why the judge ultimately gave us our answer. He gave us our judgment because we proved our case, and they failed to address much of everything that we provided. They just couldn't address it. And so they failed to raise any genuine material fact issues. It would be a horrible mistake to send us back, to remand us back for a trial on this case, because we have proved our case, we have asked for the relief, and the court, I would respectfully ask that the court should affirm this judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Rebuttal?
I'm not going to take the bait of letting Mr. Labanowski argue my rebuttal. When I was elected mayor of Cleburne recently, I had somebody try to do that. But I want to address a couple of specific points. First of all, page 8 of my brief addresses the fiduciary duty issue. EOG specifically in their summary judgment motion said they weren't moving on the fiduciary duty claim. And notably in their brief, they say that we didn't provide any evidence of a breach or that there was a duty or that they had breached it. I didn't have that obligation at the trial court level because they didn't move on it. And they specifically admitted they didn't move on it. That's one example. Regarding the claim of all of this being a fairy tale, Mr. Labanowski quoted you on page 505, "We will carry you on the vertical wells I discussed in a previous email," but he didn't go on to read the rest of it, where the EOG representative said, "Subsequent wells would not be drilled until we have seen some production. So we would have several months and would give you plenty of notice to arrange for funds." You take that in conjunction with the affidavit of Dr. Fain, and it's clear what his position was. He took the emails and the communications from EOG to mean they would carry them on the wells until one would go into production, and then they would go on to the next well. So in other words, one well at a time, and they would keep going if it was paying and producing quantities. Also, regarding the audit provision.
Carry meaning what? It's free?
No. At some point...
Whether there's production or not, he's going to have to pay.
Well, that is
at the, some point, right? That's what carry means?
That is the question, though, is at this stage, that's a fact issue. What does that mean and how long does it mean?
So you're telling me that his position was, we're going to carry you means you're not going to have to pay anything unless there's producing gas?
No, I'm not saying that. What are you saying? The word carry, what does that mean? And the fact that you raised that question, Justice McCoy, tends to militate towards the fact that that is a fact question. What does that mean? I think to concede the point, at some point there's going to be a day of reckoning. But when you look at the timeline and the content and the context of it, he said this in 06. You'll see the date. I think it was August of 06. Before he signed on for the next well, EOG told him that the first well was capable of paying and producing quantities. They told him they couldn't go to production because they didn't have a pipeline. That's an email that's in the record. And they got him to go forward. So there is an issue on that point. Regarding the audit provision, on page 347, Dr. Fain's affidavit says, they said that they were not set up to allow an audit or to allow me to have copies of or review the source documents supporting the invoices. So Mr. Labanowski has read one of the emails, and Dr. Fain, unobjected to sworn testimony provided in the summary judgment record, also says they told him that they weren't set up to do an audit. Those are fact issues. We are not on appeal after having the fact issues determined. We're here on a summary judgment grant that overexceeded what was moved upon, as well as granted a relief on fact issues. Justice Gabriel, I'd like to go back to the verification issue. I cite in my brief the State Farm case on verification. And State Farm, the Supreme Court, had talked about that issue, and they referred to it as a gotcha rule, and that we're not going to use that as a gotcha rule in this instance. So I would recommend the State Farm opinion is about as close as it comes, but this is an issue of somewhat of first impression where you have the fact scenario that we have. And I understand the concern of creating new law, but I think if you follow existing law and the policy underlying the case law as Rule 185 has progressed, not to be a gotcha rule, but when you look at the fact that he did sign the verification, it destroyed the presumption or the prima facie case. It put it in issue at that point. And when you look at the record, there's no doubt. I stated from the very beginning that the summary judgment record raises more questions than it solves. That's the quintessential fact issue. I could go through, and in my brief, I point out some of the specifics on the billing records where they're all over the board. There are bills that he was sent through his joint interest billings where they redact portions, where they bill for other wells. It challenges the credibility of whether or not those are accurate. EOG's position in this case has been, you didn't do an audit within 24 months. Sorry, you should have. But they told him, we can't do an audit. So wait 23 months, then the gotcha comes into play. For these reasons, we request the court respectfully to remand to the trial court for a trial on the merits. Trial court went way beyond the bounds of what was moved on, and there were genuine issues of material fact.
Since we're going to do additional briefing, do you need to flesh out our discussion about causes of action that you contend you pled and were not addressed by the trial court?
Justice McCoy, I cite in my brief what was moved on in the second motion.
I know, I'm asking you, do you need to flesh that out, or are you comfortable with what we've got?
I think I'm comfortable with what you have. I've got those lined up. Now, I want to make certain that my position is clear, though. I'm not saying that every one of those were raised for the first time in the second amended pleading. They were not addressed in the second summary judgment motion. Big difference.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kane. Thank you, Mr. Labanowski. Thank you, Mr. Ross and Mr. Spencer. We appreciate having you in our court today. Your case is submitted and you are excused, and we'll adjourn for the day. Yes?
If I might ask, how will I be notified about what you're
doing? How much time do you need? Would 30 days be of its ordinary time? Okay. We'll make it 30 days and we'll respond with a letter.
That is for me to file a response as though they were filing this reply brief as an amended appellate's brief.
Correct.
Yes. And with the same thought in mind, will I be given the physical ability to reply if necessary?
Well,
but
yeah.
Not 30 days. How about?
Don't we normally give half that for a reply?
15.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Seven.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
We'll put this in an order.
Yeah.
It'll come in an order.
Thank you.
All right.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second Division of Texas now stands adjourned.